The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with a story written by Rachel Walker. It was written as a special to the Washington Post originally and was published in the September 26, 2021 weekend extra edition of the News and Observer. Headlined, Camping Minimalist Learns to Love Hashtag Van Life. Miss Walker tells us her family's summer outing aboard a 19-foot travel trailer. So if you've ever wondered what that might be like, here we go. The hardest part was always going to be backing up. I knew this as soon as I picked up my Taxa Mantis Overland, a rugged 19-foot hardshell travel trailer from Great Outdoors RV in Greeley, Colorado, about an hour northeast of my home in Boulder. Despite navigating rush hour traffic, road construction, and aggressive 18-wheelers, it was backing the Mantis into my driveway that almost undid me. For those not acquainted with backing up a trailer that's hitched to their vehicle, in my case, a 2006 Toyota 4Runner, here's what it feels like. No matter which way you turn the steering wheel, it's wrong. Of course, this isn't literally true, but somehow it's entirely too easy to oversteer and jackknife, or to understeer and do an embarrassingly crooked parking job. In the subsequent days, I packed the Mantis with food and equipment for a 4,000-mile road trip, trying not to fret about the backing up that awaited me. My family of four and our dog were driving from Boulder to Vermont's Isle de Mott for a family reunion with my in-laws, whom we hadn't seen since long before the pandemic began. Before picking up the Mantis, I convinced myself that driving would be a breeze. Long ago, I had a horse and a horse trailer that I backed up all the time. Surely a 19-foot travel trailer wouldn't be much different. Somehow on, I came into possession of the Mantis Overland. For years, I've looked askance at hashtag van lifers and friends who have forwent traditional camping for tow-along trailers or RVs. I'm a longtime minimalist who wouldn't even bring a pillow on a car camping trip. Camping is for roughing it. But the pandemic forced me to rethink my asceticism. My sons are too young to be vaccinated, and we wanted to avoid any unnecessary exposure to strangers. With the Mantis, we could cook all our own meals, set up camp quickly and easily, and have a home base once we got to Vermont. We'd camp at the lake property my mother-in-law, Cassandra, owns, a small orchard with an outdoor kitchen and dilapidated barn, but currently no house. If we wanted to make the approximately 2,000-mile trip from Colorado to Vermont, and we did, camping was no longer an end in itself, but the only feasible way for us to travel this summer. I did my best to quell my anxiety, and on early Saturday morning in late July, again this is 2021, I was at the wheel as we drove out of Boulder and headed east. The trailer weighed around 4,000 pounds, and the initial driving was relatively smooth once I remembered to give myself plenty of time for braking and to give any kind of turn into a gas station, say, a wide berth. The kids practically vibrated with excitement in the back seat. Silas, my youngest, had made double the recipe of his favorite snack mix, and Henry had a nonfiction children's book on roadkill that he assured us was riveting. He planned to read it aloud on our way through Nebraska. We cut across a very flat northeastern Colorado and merged onto Interstate 80 in Nebraska. The boys cheered the cornfields while I experienced the Doppler effect of being passed by a massive long-haul truck going roughly 80 miles per hour. I felt like a flimsy sailboat in a sea of yachts, but I took a deep breath and gave myself a pep talk. The taxi was securely hitched onto my 4Runner. I had double and triple checked before our departure, and I simply needed to relax and pay attention. Soon enough, I had adapted and even ventured into the passing lane, where I accelerated without fear, then merged back into the right lane without any incidents. Trust me when I say this felt like a major accomplishment. My husband Jeff and I alternated driving with pit stops at interstate rest areas and gas stations. We'd pop into the Mattis to grab snacks or cold drinks from the electric domestic brand refrigerator. This was probably the beginning of my love affair with the trailer. Taxa was founded by a former senior architect for NASA's Habitability Design Center, which means the interior of the Mattis Overland was as dialed in as a spaceship, if more spacious. With a slick milk crate shelving system, it's more impressive than it sounds, and a place for everything, grabbing snacks or lunch and plates, bowls, etc., took less time than answering questions, like how much longer. The dog even had her own shelf, so each pit stop meant she got treats or a rawhide, and if it was her mealtime, she got kibbles. At the end of the first day on the road, I was again driving when we reached our first Campgrounds of America campground, where we'd reserved a back-end site. I was nervous. Jeff offered to park, but I turned him down. I was absolutely determined not to be the kind of woman who'd let her husband park the trailer when the going got tough. But that didn't mean I was the kind of woman who could deftly back into the campsite. I braced for humiliation, but Steve, a campground host with an easy smile and a silver goatee, asked whether I would like assistance parking. Yes, please. I followed him to our site, rolled down my window, and followed his every instruction. Reader, I parked perfectly on the first try. 15 minutes later, we had attached the hose to the water pump, plugged into shore power, also known as the campground's electricity, deployed the Taxa stabilizers, walked the dog, and changed into our swimsuits. I admit that the campground pool gave me pause, but the boys loved it and did as many cannonballs into the deep end as they could before it was closed for the day. Cooking dinner was a breeze on the two-burner propane stove, and cleaning up was even easier thanks to the separate sink and the Mattis hot water heater. By the time we turned off the many electric lights that night, I realized how relatively effortless this version of camping truly was. In fact, it could be summed up with three words. Why rough it? I heard this rhetorical question from one of our fellow campers in Nebraska who asked it as Steve admired his enormous rig. Why indeed? Tent camping, even car camping, can be tough. Gear gets jumbled. Weight and space limit what you can bring. Pre-pandemic, I tended to think of that as an invigorating challenge. But after 18 months of pandemic restrictions and all the associated difficulties, I wanted this trip to be easy. And as a particularly fastidious Virgo, I wanted to live with my family in a 19-foot trailer for almost 3 weeks without it getting cluttered or messy. As it happened, this is where the Mattis Overland really shone. The spacious interior was more like a boat than a traveling house. Everything belonged somewhere, whether in one of the milk crates or hanging from a carabiner clipped to one of the myriad holes in the steel frame, or stored in a cubby underneath the eating-slash-queen-size bed area where Jeff and I slept. There were nets everywhere to stash sundry, such as books and water bottles. We even had room for a paddleboard and a Hobie paddleboard, a kind of aquatic Stairmaster meets paddleboard contraption. It took 4 days to arrive at Isle of Mott, a picturesque island several miles south of the Canadian border on the Vermont side of Lake Champlain. After the buzz of the interstate and 3 nights in different KOA campgrounds, we were grateful for the solitude and serenity of the sleepy island. Many of its summer residents are Canadian, but the closed U.S.-Canada border prevented them from traveling south. But we weren't entirely alone. Isle of Mott has a community of full-time residents, along with a handful of hotels and vacation rentals. Cyclists frequently sped past, and from Cassandra's rocky beach, we watched speedboats, sailing crafts, paddleboarders, and kayakers. I backed up the Taxa next to her electrical outlets without Steve. This effort admittedly took more than one attempt, and we plugged in, attached a hose to one of the water pumps, dropped the trailer stabilizers, and set up the awning outside the front door. Thus settled, we relaxed into a lake vacation unlike any I've experienced before. Lake Champlain is beautiful. Long and skinny, it stretches from Canada south for nearly 125 miles. At its widest, it is only about 12 miles across. From our beach, the water was shallow and warm. We swam every day. Some days, wind whipped the water into whitecaps and forced our pedaling, paddling, or kayaking closer to shore. Other days, the water was remarkably still, like glass, and we set out in various watercraft for longer adventures. My nieces taught the boys how to dive from the swim dock. We skipped rocks for days. Each evening we built a fire, an impossibility this summer in Colorado because of wildfire danger, and we watched sublime sunsets. We ate apples and plums fresh from trees on the property, and when we needed additional provisions, we bought organic, homegrown vegetables from the Honor System farm stand at nearby Sandy Bottom Farm, or free-range chicken and fresh eggs from the Happy Bird Poultry Farm. We visited the Goodsell Ridge Fossil Preserve and the Fisk Quarry Preserve, both sites of the Chazy Fossil Relief, the oldest known biologically diverse fossil reef in the world, according to the Isle of Mott Preservation Trust. Several times we drove about 15 minutes for Creamies, now that's soft-serve ice cream for non-Vermonters, in nearby North Hero. We bought tart apples and Vermont maple syrup from Hall's Orchard. But mostly, we relaxed and had a newfound appreciation for in-person visits with loved ones. I lost track of the days. That's easy to do when life is reduced to morning coffee, breakfast, swimming, conversation, card games, lunch, reading, and dinner. Maybe this is lake life for everywhere. I wouldn't know. In landlocked Colorado, the lakes accessible to me are either snowmelt fed and freezing or crowded artificial reservoirs. And then suddenly, sadly, it was time to return home. Jeff and I had to get back to work, and the boys had only a week until school started. And so we retraced our steps. The drive home was easier, perhaps because we were experienced at driving with the taxa. We stayed at the same campgrounds and felt like old hats each time we checked in. I wouldn't say we were on par with the true RVers we met, a cohort of diehards who drive to places such as Alaska and Florida and camp in RVs that have Wolf or Cougar or Thunder in their model names. But neither were we totally green. Finally, 2,000 miles in 4 days after leaving Vermont, we arrived home to Boulder. This time I didn't fret about what I needed to do. I drove slightly past our house, positioned the trailer, and put the 4Runner in reverse. Turns out that backing up wasn't the hardest part. Without a doubt, the most difficult aspect of this particular trip was also the most inevitable, its end. Great story, huh? Well, when someone tells you they enjoyed a great meal at a 5-star restaurant, you probably aren't surprised. After all, it is a 5-star, and that's the best rating you can offer any eating establishment. But Washington Post travel writer Jonathan Edwards, no relation to me, recently encountered a traveler who had a less-than-stellar experience at a Michelin-starred restaurant in Italy, of all places. His article, A Travel Writer's Bad Review of a Michelin-starred Restaurant, went viral and appeared in the December 22, 2021 issue of the News and Observer, so let's learn more. Geraldine de Reuter, her husband and their friends, arrived at the restaurant Bros with high hopes, given that it had been awarded a Michelin star, one of the industry's most respected honors. The 27 courses that followed over the next 4.5 hours dashed those hopes, she told the Washington Post in a Monday morning phone interview, and this interview was on December 20th, 2021. The meal was the subject of a review De Reuter posted last week on her blog, The Everywhereist, that has since gone viral. One course at the restaurant in Lecce, Italy, was slivers of edible paper. Some were shots of vinegar. Another was fried cheese balls filled with what servers repeatedly described as rancid ricotta. Waiters served one course using eyedroppers to squirt liquid onto the diners' plates. They then announced this has been infused with meat molecules and walked away, De Reuter said. Perhaps the most bizarre moment of the 4-hour hunger-induced fever dream came when servers brought out a course called Chef's Kiss, citrus foam served in a plaster cast that had been molded into the shape of the chef's mouths. Under Reuter's cast, some of the foam had escaped the parted lips and dribbled down. Can you picture what this is describing? She thought the waitstaff would bring them spoons they could use to scoop out the foam. None came. We were told that we needed to kiss the mouth of the ramekin in order to slurp out the foam, she told the Post. At that point, I was like, okay, this is a Twilight Zone episode. I feel like I'm a parody of what modernist cuisine is. It was such a symphony of bizarreness on so many levels that endured and just kept going. It was an Energizer Bunny of disaster, she told CBC's As It Happens radio program. De Reuter said she and her husband paid for everyone's meal. The check for the party of eight, which included alcohol, came to 1,350 euros, or roughly 1,522 U.S. dollars. Rose responded to an inquiry from the Today Show with a declaration of Chef Floriano Pellegrino, a three-page document featuring a series of pictures that each show a rider on horseback. The first is a fairly simplistic drawing, the second is Jacques-Louis David's painting, Napoleon Crossing the Alps, and the third is an abstract painting that's almost unrecognizable. Many can produce the first drawing, and similarly a lot of people can whip up the culinary equivalent, Pellegrino wrote in his response. It's not that hard, but most people will admire you. Only great cooks who've studied and trained for years can make spectacular food, just as David depicted Napoleon. The problem with this artist is that many artists have made paintings like him. I admire the quality, it's well done, but I am bored with spectacular paintings like that, Pellegrino wrote. The Louvre and the Prado and the Hermitage are full with such stuff. It's impressive, but it's shallow. Pellegrino and Bros are interested in making the kind of food that's equivalent to the third abstract painting, he said. This kind of food forces those who make it to doubt everything, including themselves. In doing so, they ask big questions. What is art? What is food? What is a chef? What is a client? What is good taste? What looks beautiful? What is a man on a horse? De Reuter admitted that Pellegrino made some valid points. Food, like art, should challenge people and make them uncomfortable to a certain degree. But when we are talking about food in a restaurant, that isn't just art. That's also hospitality, she told the Post. Should you bring them new experiences? Absolutely. Should you challenge them? Absolutely. But should their experience be unpleasant? I don't think so. At the end of his written response to today, Pellegrino addressed Limon Niamo, the plaster mold that during De Reuter's meal held the citrus foam. Buyers can purchase the mold, which comes in the shape of either Pellegrino's mouth or the mouth of fellow chef Isabella Pott, for 58 euros. We thank Mrs. Triple X, I don't remember her name, for making us to get where we had not yet arrived. We are out of stock of Limoniamo. Thank you very much. Oh, my word. Okay, we're going to put aside our chef's lips in a to-go bag, and we're now going to head to the city of brotherly love, where Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Kevin Reardon tells us about saving Jewish cemeteries one stone at a time. His article was published in the December 1st, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. On an otherwise quiet morning at Har Nebo, the venerable Jewish cemetery in northeast Philadelphia, the clinking of Joe Farinani's hammer and chisel was the sound of history being made to last. Farinini has been meticulously reassembling, resetting, and cleaning the broken, sunken, fallen, or discolored stones on 32 graves at Har Nebo. It's a pilot project the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia hopes will provide conservation models for others among the 30 Jewish burial grounds in the city and the Pennsylvania suburbs. Gravestones may be the only record that someone was here on this planet, and preserving them is important to me, Farinini said. A big part of the mission is to make sure these people aren't forgotten. Gravestones, he said, tell the stories of why we are who we are. More than 34,000 people are buried at Har Nebo, the Hebrew name for the mountain that gave Moses his first glimpse of the Promised Land and became his burial place. The cemetery in the Oxford Circle neighborhood was established in 1890. Rabbi Lent Sussman, a Reformed congregation, Knesset Israel, who is doing research for a documentary project with filmmaker Sam Katz, said Philadelphia's Jewish population grew from 12,000 to 200,000 between 1880 and 1920 as waves of immigrants arrived from Russia and Eastern Europe. Some of those men and women, their children, and later descendants are among those memorialized by the granite and marble stones, some modest, others grand, that cover the 28 acres of Nebo. 10 of my ancestors are here, said Richard Blumberg, 60, a Montgomery Township business consultant who was dismayed by the condition of the cemetery during a visit with his son in late 2020. While their family's members' graves were in good condition, Farinini estimates that a third of all the other stones are sinking, leaning, lying face down, or broken in pieces. Looking around, I thought, I can't accept this, said Blumberg, who's been helping focus attention on Har Nebo ever since. The Federation's Friends of Jewish Cemeteries project has raised more than $15,000 toward a $20,000 goal to cover the cost of the pilot. On October 17th, the cleanup brought more than 350 volunteers to the gates on Oxford Avenue. They pruned shrubs, cut weeds, and filled 100 bags with vegetation and debris. "We would not have gotten this far or this fast without Rich's leadership," said Addie Lewis Klein, a senior director with the Federation. "We get phone calls every single week from community members who are concerned about the state of our older cemeteries," Klein said. "This is a community-wide problem. It needs a communal solution, and it's going to take some time, money, and expertise." In 2017, the Federation rallied support for Mount Carmel Cemetery in the city's Wissonoming neighborhood. About 275 gravestones had been desecrated by vandals, and Farinini led that successful conservation effort. Mount Carmel and Harnibo are both owned by the family of Richard Levy, or Levy, who told the Jewish Exponent newspaper there were only 44 burials at Harnibo in 2020. He did not respond to a voicemail or emails from an Inquirer reporter. Surrounded by a chain-link fence topped with barbed wire amid the working-class row houses and apartments of Oxford Circle, Harnibo does not appear to have been vandalized. But on stable ground, the cemetery was built on the site of a factory that made bricks from the clay soil there, has caused many gravestones to tilt precipitously or fall over altogether. "This can be dangerous work, and volunteers shouldn't try to do it," said Farinini, estimating that even a smallish granite stone can weigh 600 pounds. Interest in Jewish and other burial grounds has deepened in recent years as the Internet and the availability of inexpensive DNA tests have popularized genealogical research. Bloomberg himself was inspired to visit Harnibo while writing a book about his family's history. "Cemeteries are special places," said Felicia Mode Alexander, president of the Jewish Genealogical and Archival Society of Greater Philadelphia. A self-described history geek, she grew up in Boston and remembers visiting the graves of family members in the historic Ohabai Shalom Cemetery. "It was a goosebump experience," she said. "When I walked among these headstones, I knew they were part of my gene pool, my ancestry. I felt connected to them." Cemeteries also create connections among the living. During the October 17th cleanup, sisters Marcy Green and Jane Bender were heartbroken to find the monument of their great-grandfather, Oscar Loeb, was lying on the ground at the family plot. As the sisters stood there, Barbara Levine and Jeremy Rothman, whom they didn't know and who didn't know each other, walked over. The four engaged in a time-honored custom known as Jewish geography and quickly realized they are cousins, and all four returned to see Oscar's stone repaired and reset in its proper place. "It was emotional thinking about our common ancestors, knowing we were there, taking care of their monuments and honoring them," said Green. "Since meeting, we four have talked about reaching out and finding other relatives and having a reunion," said Farinini, a lifelong history lover who learned gravestone work by doing it. "Three separate branches of the family were coming together around a stone, and I was able to reset for them and hear the story. It was gratifying on so many levels to take something that looked like a total loss and put it back to a better state so people can enjoy the artistry and the information on it," he said. Dennis Montagna, a historian at the National Park Service's Northeast Regional Office in Philadelphia, has been offering guidance and encouragement to the efforts at Harnibo through NPS's Monument Research and Preservation Program. "Ideally, with these cemeteries, you want there to be ongoing maintenance," he said, "but it's like a perfect storm of deferred maintenance, expensive and labor-intensive stonework to do, and very little income coming in. So it really depends on other people to help retool these cemeteries as places to visit and learn history," said Montagna. "It's a real challenge, but these monuments meant so much to people. There's stories about everything." Alexander of the Genealogical Society has been researching the lives of a couple of people buried at Harnibo and will contribute them to the pilot project's archive. One involves a Philly soldier who was killed in France during World War I, and whose remains were later repatriated. His name was Herman Spielberg. "When he came back to Philadelphia, a cousin retrieved the body for burial at Harnibo," she said. "He was an only child, and his family died without him. I went there and found his grave. It's a beautiful monument, a stone in the shape of a tree trunk. There was no one left to place a stone on his grave, as Jewish people do, so I went back and put a stone on his grave and said, "Thank you for your service, and I will tell your story." Great story there, huh? Well, we're going to wrap up our journey on today's Armchair Traveler by looking back, up, and ahead. 2021 was a big year for space. 2022 could be even bigger. Written by Washington Post reporter Christian Davenport, it appeared in the December 28, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. The year 2021 will probably go down in the annals of space history as a turning point, a moment when ordinary citizens started leaving Earth on a regular basis. Multiple crews lifted off several different spacecraft, and for a brief moment, it became, in time rather, or in December, there were a record 19 people in the weightless environment of space, and 8 of them were private citizens. But for all the achievements of 2021, which include a rover landing on Mars, a small drone called Ingenuity flying on that planet's thin atmosphere, and the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, the most powerful space telescope ever, 2022 could hold just as much promise, if not more, and I'll inject a breaking news item here. The James Webb Telescope yesterday reached its achieved orbit level and everything in place, and it's about 1 million miles out, and that's about 3 times the distance of the moon, according to the report I saw. So there you go. So we're already headed in that direction, and we'll have more of the James Webb Space Telescope, I'm sure, in future episodes. Back to our story. If 2021 was the year of the private space tourist, 2022 could be marked by the first steps toward a return to the moon. As NASA and the growing space industry seek to maintain the momentum that has been building over the past several years in what has amounted to a renaissance of exploration. A pair of massive rockets, both more powerful than a Saturn V that flew the Apollo astronauts to the moon, are getting ready to fly in 2022. Those launches would mark the first significant steps in NASA's Artemis program, which aims to return astronauts to their lunar surface by 2025 and create a campaign that would allow a permanent presence on and around the moon. After years of development and billions of dollars spent, NASA's finally gearing up to launch its Space Launch System rocket and Orion crew capsule, which are designed to return astronauts to the moon for the first time since Apollo. First mission, known as Artemis 1, is scheduled for March or April and would send Orion without any crew on board to orbit around the moon. If all goes well, it would be followed by Artemis 2 in May 2024, which would again send Orion to orbit the moon, but this time with astronauts on board. NASA hopes a crew would be able to land on the moon by 2025, but that would depend on the success of previous flight tests and SpaceX's ability to get its Starship spacecraft up and running. Over the past year, Elon Musk's SpaceX has been moving feverishly toward the first orbital launch of Starship, the vehicle that won a $3 billion NASA contract this year to rendezvous with the Orion and transport NASA's astronauts to the lunar surface. A lot to look forward to in future episodes, right? And that, my friend, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.